Public radio is here for you. It doesn't matter how old you are, how big your home is, or what kind of car you drive. WOSU and NPR connect you to news and information in civil conversations. That's why 43 million Americans listen to NPR each week. WOSU is part of our community, covering and discussing issues important to you, standing with the facts. Meet the moment with WOSU. Go to WOSU.org/protect.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. A favorite summer pastime can be enjoying a music performance by your favorite artist. And if it's a stadium tour by an artist like Beyoncé or Taylor Swift, attending the concert can become a major event involving travel, hotels, new outfits, and more. However, with stadium tours on the rise, the complications of seeing these shows and enjoying them is becoming harder. That's the focus of an article by our guest, Kendall Cunningham, a staff reporter for Vox who focuses on culture. Welcome to All Sides.
Hi, how are you?
Thanks for joining us today. Your article that you recently wrote was called Stadium Tours Are the Worst Summer Hang. It's your favorite artist plus 80,000 other people. So in the article, you asked a question, basically, stadium tours are on the rise. Are fans loving them? Did you find an answer? Are fans loving them?
I think it's a mix of love and hate. I think a lot of people realize that they don't really have a choice at this point when it comes to huge artists. You know, right now we have Beyonce on tour. The past 2 years, it was Beyonce and Taylor Swift. Post Malone is going on a stadium tour at Sheeran. Chris Brown is going on a stadium tour. So I think a lot of people are sort of just putting up with these sort of inevitable compromises that come with seeing their favorite artist. But, you know, it's a mix of excitement because it is this really fun preparation experience in terms of getting dressed up and taking photos and posting on social media. But you don't always get the best view. You don't always get the best sound. So it's a little bit of both.
Yeah. I mean, some of these stadiums, if they're newer, they could have been designed for both a sports event and maybe to hold concerts. But older stadiums, I mean, they were just designed to have sports in them. They're not designed to hold a giant concert. Is that right?
Yeah, for sure. They're not built for optimal acoustics. They're built for a visual experience, watching a sports play out. And the audience obviously provides the backup noise. When I spoke to Brian Murican, who is the co-director for live entertainment at this live design firm called Populous, he told me that stadiums are slowly working towards building up the sound quality, but for the most part, it's not what it could be, and it's not the same sort of sound quality as an arena.
Yeah, and then you wrote that in stadiums, the experience is different. Some people like having 80,000 people singing along with them, but other people want to hear the music. Where do you feel like is there a fine line there, or is it just run the gamut of who enjoys this?
I think that I understand for a lot of people that the idea of being surrounded by thousands of people and having this almost like religious experience has its own value to it. And then I think there's other people who, you know, considering how much money they're shelling out for these tickets, would really just like to have a more sort of pure experience of like enjoying the music, being able to hear everything clearly, being able to see all the visuals that these artists invest so much money for and into. So I think there's, you know, it's not, you know, my opinion is my opinion, but yeah. I think for the most part, you know, you're going to find people who love it and hate it. But I think on social media, it's become visible how many people are really starting to sort of feel comfortable vocalizing these complaints as stadium tours are becoming such an inescapable thing.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the cash, because how much cash you have to put down to get your ticket can be significant. Why are people willing to spend so much money on these concerts, on these big stadium tours?
I mean, there's definitely a fear of missing out. You know, there have been studies that have shown that Gen Z is more likely to make these purchases because they feel like they're missing out on an experience that all their other peers are having. You're seeing it all over social media. The pressure is everywhere to attend these events and be able to post about it. And I also think that, these are huge artists and it feels like once in a lifetime experiences when you do have someone like Beyoncé who puts out an album, maybe every 5 years you do want to see her when she does go on tour, or Taylor Swift. Her Eras Tour was a once in a lifetime experience, her sort of going back through her entire catalog. That felt like something you couldn't miss. So I think it's a mix of these huge artists who obviously are amazing performers and have reputations for putting on a good show, and the sort of social aspect of feeling like you have to be in on this, party that everyone else went to.
And a part of the reason the ticket costs so much is the rarity of it, is the experience. It's hard to put a value on that kind of experience, especially for Taylor Swift, if you don't know if it's going to happen again, that kind of thing. But this is also how these artists are making money now, because you can stream music. Like, there, people are not the artists are not making money off of buying albums anymore. Is that correct?
Yeah, streaming is not doing it for a lot of artists, even huge artists like, Taylor Swift and Harry Styles and Beyoncé. They touring is how they make a lot of their money. And with stadium tours, the production of them is often a lot cheaper because a lot of times they are staying at the same stadium for multiple nights. Beyoncé just did a MetLife, did like five MetLife shows in a row. Usually if they go to a big city, they'll stay in the same place for a while, and there's not that much traveling. And then, yeah, it's just like an easy way to recoup from the pandemic losses and not being able to go on tour for about 2 years. So, yeah, they're definitely making more money this way. Obviously, the more seats too are, the more tickets being bought.
Yeah, but the fans have to travel. If your tour, like Beyonce, only has 10 to 15 stops on it, people have to drive from other states to get to the closest venue, right? So there then there, that's where the hotel and it becoming kind of like, this is your vacation going to this tour, going to this concert.
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, we're the ones spending more, and like my personal experience, I'm seeing her. I found it cheaper to actually see her to see Beyoncé in London as opposed to New York, which is wild. So I'm going to be seeing her there. So, yeah, it's a whole thing.
Yes, I know several people who traveled to Europe and decided to make a European vacation about it to see Taylor Swift because the tickets were only $200 or $300 as opposed to $2,000 each year, right? Something like
Yeah,
that.
it's.
Yes.
Yeah, and people are like, well, we might as well make a whole trip out of it. So it's a weird thing.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about whether fans are getting the most enjoyment from stadium tours. It's the stadium tours they attend with Kendall Cunningham, cultural reporter for Vox. So we're going to talk about Ticketmaster and Live Nation in the next segment. But in your opinion, from your reporting, how has their monopoly affected the concert experience? Are they a part of the reason that these tickets cost so much?
For sure. I mean, we've seen them allow resellers to sort of come in, and they're doing a better job of stopping people from reselling tickets, but we've seen them sort of allow these bots, specifically with the Eras Tour, to take up tickets really fast, resell them on other sites. And there's not a lot of pressure for them to really make these changes because they have such a monopoly on the ticket distribution industry. They're the main vendor, and their merger with Live Nation has only made them more powerful. So yeah, they're definitely a huge issue, and one that's obviously being worked out on the federal level. They're being sued by the Justice Department for basically running what they have alleged as like an illegal monopoly on ticket distribution.
And what have you heard from people? Because a part of the problem is that they're selling some of these seats for different prices. So, it can be the same seat, but on a different night, and it just costs wildly different, depending on, I guess, a lot of different factors that no one really understands. Is that what you were finding?
Yeah, the ticket pricing is strange. And then you're also seeing, like with the Cowboy Carter tour, for example, tickets for a 300, 400 section seat may have been, $400. And then as the show is coming closer and the seats that are on the lower levels aren't selling out, those are being reduced. So people are trying to, switch their tickets out, but they can't because they can only exchange with tickets that are the same prices as the one that they bought originally. So it's a lot of, it feels very arbitrary. And I feel like they're sort of understanding that now it's kind of coming back to, it's not, yeah.
People are using social media to, like, there's this whole chain. I don't know if it's on Reddit or where, but there's this whole chain where people are like, tell me where your seat is and what you paid for it. And they're trying to, like, expose the inequities, right?
Yeah, for sure. It's a lot of people sort of sharing their experiences and feeling emboldened to sort of speak out about these, so-called injustices that they're dealing with, whether it's the Ticketmaster or just, even the sort of the way that they're being handled by the stadium staff. We had a lot of people complaining about the VIP pits and like how those were handled on the Cowboy Carter tour, how they didn't really know where they were supposed to be or were put in the wrong places. So it's really this like network of people coming together and sort of warning one another and also like encouraging them, like, okay, maybe buy tickets in this section instead of this section, you'll get a better view and better sound. Yeah, it's created this really interesting and kind of helpful network on TikTok.
Do you feel like fans who have a not ideal experience, do they blame Ticketmaster? Do they blame the stadium? Or are they mad at Beyonce?
I mean, I've seen a lot of people, it seems to be a mix of all three. I think the people who I talked to about the VIP situation, it was a lot of the people who worked at the stadium not really, seemingly not having good communication with the organizers. And I think Beyonce, I think people have given Beyonce a lot of credit that like she's fixed these issues upon seeing them on social media, or at least her, whoever's working for her has like clocked these issues. She's moved the stage around. She's made sure to like walk to different sections. I know the VIP pit, which was like further away from the stage, got moved closer after people complained. But I think for the large part, I do think the money is where people are the most upset when it comes to like the cost. And I think Ticketmaster is really who people are sort of aiming their ire at the moment.
And back to the money for a second. I mean, you wrote that the top 100 facilities increased. There, 1.4 billion was made in 2019, and it increased to 2.6 billion with a B in 2022. So, I mean, this is a lot of money. That is just a few short years, and it is, one side of the pandemic to the other, and it's more than $1.5 billion more being made on these tours. So, I guess stadium tours are probably here to stay, right?
Yeah, there doesn't seem like much of an incentive for artists to downsize at this point, just seeing how much money there is to be made. And I think also for artists, beyond sort of the profits that they can make, it is really the statement of dominance as an artist to be able to say that you sold out, 5 nights at MetLife, or Yankee Stadium or wherever. And I think, everyone wants to be sort of known as the biggest artist in the world. So I think, it's something that's just going to stick around and stay.
Have there been instances, though? I feel like there's been instances where some concerts have been canceled in certain cities because they were not selling out, the whole 70,000 seats. Is that true?
I've definitely heard that for arenas recently. I know like in the news, I'm thinking like Jennifer Lopez was in the news recently for her arena tour not really selling out that well. But for the most part, I think stadiums have been a pretty like steady bet for a lot of artists.
You also just before we end here, I'm being told that the Black Keys canceled a full national tour due to low sales. So maybe it just depends on the size of the artist you are, whether you belong in a stadium or not. You have to have that
Yeah,
reality.
yeah.
It's
You'll
a
find out very quickly.
right. So it's a reality check, I think, something like that. But before we end, I just wanted to talk a little bit more about the spiritual experience, because whenever there, you wrote that there's something about having 80,000 fans screaming and cheering and singing in unison that's what people are paying for. That's the experience. Do you feel like is that the experience for the stadium tour? It's that communal spirit.
Yeah, I mean, I think, money and profits aside, I do think there is value for certain people in seeing and being sort of around that many people and experiencing an artist that you love that much. It does come kind of close to like a religious experience or church or whatever. I mean, these pop stars are sort of like, gods to people at this point, specifically, the footage that we've seen from the Eras tour. I think that's probably the best promotion for stadiums. Just how excited people are being together, the sort of friendship aspect. They passed around like friendship bracelets at the Eras tour. I know people have made friends at stadium tours, and it becomes this like whole thing that people plan to do together, kind of like a pilgrimage almost. So there's definitely the communal aspect is definitely something that people like, whether or not there are certain things that can obviously be improved on when seeing a stadium concert. But I think people who see them like being surrounded by that many people.
Can you tell me about the post-concert amnesia experience that some people have experienced, especially after seeing a Taylor Swift concert?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that speaks to weirdly like the downside of maybe having that quote unquote religious experience and being so overwhelmed with emotions. Researchers did find when people who saw the Eras tour were reporting that they had sort of like immediately forgot the next day, like the order of the songs, and like they couldn't remember sequences. Researchers did find that it probably had a lot to do with just like the heightened emotions and like you're so amped up that you can't really process what you're seeing in real time or like sort of bank it in your memory. So that is like a weird downside to like having this really spiritual experience, but also maybe not being able to recall everything the next day.
Well, we will see what happens as future stadium tours go about, whether post-concert amnesia continues. Maybe people can learn to, like, be in the moment and figure out how to overcome that. Yeah. We've been speaking with Kendall Cunningham, a cultural reporter for Vox. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me. Have a good day.
And coming up, we are going to be talking about the monopoly that Ticketmaster and Live Nation have over the price you pay for these concert tickets. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you're going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. Kendrick Lamar, Ed Sheeran, and Post Malone are a few of the big concert names selling out stadium tours around the country. Taylor Swift's Eras Tour broke records, and now Beyoncé is breaking records on major stadium tours as well. We're talking about the rise of the stadium tour and the fan experience this hour on All Sides. A determining factor regarding whether a fan will attend a concert or not is the ticket price. The cost of some concert tickets is the equivalent of rent in some cities. An ongoing complaint is the monopoly Ticketmaster and Live Nation have over the price you pay for tickets, which can change depending on where you live. Morgan Harper has been leading the Break Up Ticketmaster Coalition. She is Director of Policy and Advocacy at the American Economic Liberties Project, a nonprofit organization advocating for corporate accountability legislation and enforcement of antitrust regulations. Morgan Harper, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks for having me.
So why do Ticketmaster and Live Nation have such a stranglehold on concert ticket sales?
Yeah, it's a great question. And to start, we have to call out the fact that the government did approve a merger that allowed Live Nation, which was very dominant in the control of venues, to then merge with Ticketmaster in 2010. And that was dominant in the ticketing industry. And so that combination has allowed them to pretty much control all of the live events industry. And it created what's called a flywheel. So they're able to leverage their control over owning venues, running concert promotion, and then use it to extract very high fees and prices in the ticketing business. And it's pretty much game over for anyone who's trying to compete in any of those business lines to provide more options in the market and more competition.
Do they even still have a competitor? I mean, is it kind of like smaller things? Like here in Columbus, we have Kappa through like I think it's Cbus Arts does tickets. Is that the only competitors they have, just individual city by city?
Well, there are companies that have tried to enter the ticketing space, but you're exactly right, Amy. I mean, if you're trying to gain serious market share, no one can take on a giant like Live Nation. And that's exactly why the Department of Justice last year filed a lawsuit to sue them for monopolizing the live events industry. And not just the Department of Justice at the federal level, but 40 attorneys general, including Dave Yost, our own Attorney General of Ohio, just showing the bipartisan nature of this claim. They sued to allege that, yes, for purposes of the live events industry, including venue ownership, artist management, and ticketing, there is very little competition because of Live Nation's monopolistic conduct.
What about things like SeatGeek and StubHub? Are they separate? Are they competing against Ticketmaster?
They're trying. And so those are two of the companies that, for example, if you look at SeatGeek had a partnership at a venue in New York City where the Brooklyn Nets play and the Barclays Center. And that was, enabling them to gain a little bit more of a market share for that industry. But the issue was they've now switched, that venue switched to Ticketmaster. We don't know all the details as to why, but what we've heard from a lot of our contacts in the artist management space and artists themselves is that if you're trying to play ball and some of the artists you mentioned and really make money off of running a tour, well, then you need to be able to get into some of the largest venues in the country. And Ticketmaster, because through Live Nation, they also own a lot of those venues, are going to be your ability to do that. So StubHub and SeatGeek, yes, they're providing alternatives, but if they're not able to get into partnership agreements with some of these large venues, and they aren't going to be able to do that if Live Nation themselves own the venues, well, then it's going to be very difficult for them to really get ahead.
So if we're now suing because it's a monopoly, why were these companies allowed to merge to begin with back in 2010? Was it a mis- I guess you would just say it was a mistake, right?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it's a question that, the 100,000 people that we got through the Breakup Ticketmaster Coalition to tell the DOJ to unwind the merger, we're certainly asking themselves and feel like they have the answer to. It was a mistake. I mean, there has been this idea for a while in antitrust enforcement, over the past 40 years that, we stay away from strong, what are called structural remedies that would force companies to change their business structures. And we kind of trust the companies to figure it out. And so in 2010, when the merger was approved, there were what are called behavioral remedies that are just saying, okay, Live Nation, Ticketmaster, yes, this is maybe presenting some competitive concerns, but we're just going to force you to license a bit of your product, maybe divest a couple of venues, and then that's going to be enough, and we'll just monitor and see how things go. The issue with that is when you have a company as powerful as Live Nation, and that merger definitely accelerated their ability to become even more powerful, compliance with these types of consent decrees at best become a bit of a rounding error. I mean, they can afford to violate consent decrees, and even if there's a fine, they'll pay it and it's not a big deal, and they'll continue abusing a lot of venue owners and certainly us as fans and charging high ticket prices because they don't really have to change. They know the government can't keep up with them. And so that's why it was so encouraging to see, and under the last administration that a case was brought to take their market power head on. And the lawsuit suggested that the government would be seeking structural remedies and forcing some of the divestments of these business lines so that Live Nation wouldn't be able to control the entire industry. So yes, a mistake was made, but hopefully we'll see in this new administration under President Trump a continuation of what was seen as monopolistic conduct.
Now, in 2019, the Department of Justice did make some changes to that merger agreement. Did any of that work? Or is this what you're saying, where it's just sort of fines that Live Nation can afford to swallow?
Yeah, if they have to agree to it at all. And so, you know, what we've heard from a lot of venue owners, from artists again, who really are bearing the brunt of this, in addition to fans, there's a lot of focus on ticket prices because we all pay that. But for independent venue owners, for people who are small business owners really trying to make a living in this industry, and artists themselves who want to be able to provide a better experience to their fans, we're hearing there's just no option. Either you're playing with Live Nation or you're not going to be able to make money at all. And so, yes, there was the changes to the consent decree, but those also weren't taken very seriously. And they've continued to abuse other players in the market.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and I'm Amy Jurevich. We're talking about the hold Ticketmaster and Live Nation has over concert ticket sales with Morgan Harper, Director of Policy and Advocacy at the American Economic Liberties Project. Now, as far back as 1994, Pearl Jam canceled a tour and testified to Congress about Ticketmaster keeping the prices too high. So can you explain how this was an issue long before Ticketmaster merged with Live Nation?
Yeah, it has been an issue for a long time. And I think the Pearl Jam example is a good one because that was an example of an artist that did try to take on the dominance of Ticketmaster just in ticketing. And yes, that was before Ticketmaster was merged with Live Nation. So that was just an issue with the dominance in the ticketing business line alone. And they tried to organize tours apart from Ticketmaster using, you know, their own ticketing system so that they would be able to provide more affordable experiences to their fans. And they couldn't do it. They couldn't gain access to enough places to be able to pull that off. And they were retaliated against. I mean, I think that's the other thing to keep in mind here. When we say that the venues are facing abuse in the market, it's that if you don't agree to the terms that Live Nation Ticketmaster is offering you as a venue, then you will be skipped over as they are putting together their concert promotion plans. Mm-hmm. That's what that abusive conduct looks like. And as an independent venue, as a small business owner, if you're not able to receive to be one of the stops on an artist tour, well, then that's your business. You're done. So that was all happening in the 90s, and that's why it was such a mistake in 2010. I mean, the writing was on the wall. There were efforts and organizing efforts that happened from the artist community, from independent venues, to tell the government in 2010, don't approve this merger. This is going to ruin us. And they did it anyway. And so, you know, that's why I think a lot of people, when we started the coalition, even folks that ended up signing on, were a little bit reticent because they were like, you know, we've been through this before. It didn't work. If you put yourself out there, you could face this kind of retaliation. It's not worth the risk. And we really had to coax people to believe that the government might actually step up and act differently here. And I do think, you know, part of the reason why we were optimistic is we were starting to see people organically just on Twitter, especially after the pandemic, that were complaining about these high ticket prices and saying, I hate Ticketmaster. And, you know, and oftentimes in our world, one of the hardest things is to explain to people how some of these market dynamics are happening behind the scenes that are contributing to the direct, you know, the bad consumer experience. But here it was very clear. And so we felt confident that we'd be able to create the political momentum to hopefully pressure the government to do the right thing. And so we were so excited then to see DOJ bring this case.
Why did you name your coalition Break Up Ticketmaster instead of Break Up Live Nation? Is it just because more people hate Ticketmaster?
Well, yeah, more recognizable brand for sure. Yeah. So I think that was the big motivation there. And look, I mean, I think a lot of times, you know, with these issues with antitrust and we even hear this from Live Nation themselves. I mean, there's a lot of overcomplication of what the issue is to try to justify the illegal conduct. And we thought it could be very simple here. There was a merger approved that allowed Live Nation to merge with Ticketmaster. Just break it up. Break it up. Force these structural remedies. You know, that's very easy for the public to understand. Apparently over 100,000 people in the public did. And that's why, you know, the open question here is what will happen in this new administration. But it's not a complicated issue. The politics might complicate the outcome, but the problem is quite clear.
Taylor Swift has a considerable amount of power in the music business. How did her most recent tour call attention to some Ticketmaster issues?
Yeah, I think, you know, it was interesting. We started the coalition just a couple weeks before her Eras Tour launched, and then there was the meltdown with her early ticket sales. I think what it did was really bring attention to an even broader audience. Like I said, we were seeing organic traffic even the summer before on social media, people complaining about Ticketmaster. But Taylor Swift being one of the most popular artists in the world, she has a very well-organized fan base already in Swifties. And so they were able to leverage that existing organizing to then be able to apply it to a message of monopolies, of break up Ticketmaster, in ways that, you know, we as a little nonprofit would never be able to do. So I think it really accelerated just the public's understanding of Live Nation's monopoly and the impacts that it's having and for all of us, but especially for the fan experience, and added to that momentum that then led eventually to the Department of Justice lawsuit.
And there's been a lot of inequities regarding specifically Beyonce's Cowboy Carter tour about ticket prices, because she's doing multiple nights in the same city. And now there's just this movement on social media for people to disclose, like, where are you sitting and what did you pay for your seat, so that everyone can just know. And so I have a case in point here where a fan paid $500 for a seat in section 127, but on a different day of the week, a fan paid $1,700 for that same exact seat, right? And now they know that. And like, what can you do about that?
Yeah, and it's interesting because another threat to Live Nation's monopoly power and their dominance in the live events industry is they have access to a tremendous amount of data. So even though you don't think of Ticketmaster as a technology company, they are very much a technology company. They know what we've bought.
Oh, no. When I sat in a queue trying to get tickets, they are a technology company, because when the technology doesn't work and you're sitting there, you know. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And just that level of access to data then gives a lot of pricing power. And so, you know, in dynamic pricing in ways that we are probably not aware of, that they're able to manipulate that data to make sure that they're maximizing how much money they're making off of each ticket. So, you know, it's great that people on their own organically in the public are disclosing these prices, trying to create more transparency. There was actually a rule that has now been implemented that came out of the last administration, the Federal Trade Commission, on getting rid of junk fees in the live events industry. So mm-hmm. Live Nation announced they're going to comply with that. They're going to make, you know, prices available, all-in pricing, as it's called, so that you know the price of the ticket up front. But to your point, even those efforts don't necessarily change what the price is. It could still be very high. It could still be different day to day. And so that's why, to really get at the core issue, the business model of Live Nation has to change. And that's why it's so important that this lawsuit continues and pursues structural remedies.
Well, and it varies city to city, because New York was more expensive than LA. New York and LA are both more expensive than Houston. So, but shouldn't a seat in the 300 level, whether you're in LA or in New York, probably be the same price-ish?
Well, I mean, look, I think that there's probably some differences in cost in pulling off tours in different cities based on whatever the labor inputs are, and, you know, and some of the products that go into just the equipment to pull off the tour. That's possible. I'm not an expert in actually executing on event mm-hmm. production, but I imagine there could be some variance there. But I think what you're getting at, and in some ways, the even more important point is that, you know, there needs to be some bounds, though, on just how much these prices can vary, and also that there's some consistency in the pricing. And that's never going to come when you only have one market player that is able to set the price. That happens through competition, where right now, I mean, Live Nation can do this because what is anybody going to do about it? If there was an alternative, for example, if at a different venue in a city, there was a different ticketing platform that was being used, because they're not able to demand that a venue use Ticketmaster, and that ticketing platform, the alternative ticketing platform, was pricing their tickets in a more not just transparent way, but in a fairer way that didn't fluctuate as much, people would likely choose that ticketing platform and that venue. But that's not the case right now. And so, again, I mean, it really is the market power, that flywheel that allows them to control both ticketing and concert promotion and artist management, venue ownership, that makes it all game over and gives them this enormous pricing power.
Can you tell me about ticket scalping? Does Ticketmaster benefit at all from ticket scalping? If there's efforts to, like, what is the effort to get more tickets to concert goers rather than just resellers?
Yeah, and you know, this is something that the Breakup Ticketmaster Coalition hasn't focused on. We've been pretty laser focused to, you know, our earlier conversation about the clarity of the message on addressing the business model and pursuing the structural remedy and breakup of the company. You know, for sure, scalpers and bots and all these things are contributing to higher prices. There have been legislative efforts as well to take this on. Actually, Senator Blackburn from Tennessee has been at the forefront of this and reintroduced legislation to address that. And so, you know, that's important. But if we're not, if we don't see from the government, whether it's Congress or at the executive level from the Department of Justice, you know, the addressing of the market power issue and some of the structures of the business model, then we're not going to see the large scale change for all of these different players in the market, not just us as fans and lowering prices, but also that independent venues have more autonomy over running their businesses and that artists are able to have more control over the types of tours that they want to put on for us as fans.
All right. So where are we in the process? When is there a hearing coming up? Is there any movement or is everything just take forever because it's the Department of Justice?
So federal litigations do take, oh, all litigation, but especially federal big antitrust cases can take a while. And we did see new leadership come in. Gail Slater is now the head of the Trump administration's antitrust division. But, you know, already they've hosted a roundtable that included artists and independent venue owners to hear about what's, you know, the state of competition in the live events industry. That's an encouraging sign. In a whole different market area, we've seen from this administration a commitment, you know, in their case against Google to pursue structural remedies and change the business model of Google search, for example. So, you know, that indicates that there is a certain comfort level with pursuing these kinds of breakup remedies in a litigation, which is also a good sign. But, you know, there's other headwinds here. We've also seen that Live Nation has now appointed someone, Richard Grenell, who is pretty prominent in President Trump's orbit, to their board, likely an effort to try to grease the wheels to a possible settlement. You know, if the alternative to pursuing this litigation and a strong case that could result in the breakup of Live Nation Ticketmaster is settling to produce something like a consent decree that, as we discussed, doesn't really do anything to change Live Nation's behavior, or they drop the case altogether. Those are also possibilities. So, you know, hopefully we won't see that. These efforts to try to, you know, bring more folks from the administration in the orbit of the company is certainly a nod towards, you know, trying to get to something other than a breakup. But hopefully we'll see the administration do the right thing here, which is bring competition back to the live events industry.
Our guest has been Morgan Harper, Director of Policy and Advocacy at the American Economic Liberties Project, also a part of the Breakup Ticketmaster Coalition. Morgan, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And coming up, we're going to talk about what goes into designing a stadium when it comes to concerts versus sporting events in order for you to get the most out of your experience. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Planet Money helps you understand the economy. We find the people at the center of the story.
Garbage in New York, that was like a controlled substance.
We show you how money influences everything.
Tell me what you like by telling me how you spend your money.
And we dig until we get answers.
I had a bad feeling you were going to bring that up.
Planet Money finds out. All you have to do is listen. The Planet Money podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. From the wooded lawns of Tanglewood in Massachusetts to the natural beauty of Red Rocks in Colorado, venues can be as much of a draw as the performer. But with concert stadium tours on the rise, how are venues designed to ensure concertgoers can get the most out of their experience? Joining us now is Brian Marakian, Senior Principal and Co-Director of Populous, a live venue design firm in Kansas City. Welcome to All Sides, Brian.
Hi, Amy. It's great to be here.
So your architecture firm, Populous, has created some of the most popular sports and entertainment venues in the world. It includes Camden Yards in Baltimore, Oracle Park in San Francisco, The Sphere in Las Vegas. How has stadium design evolved ever since Populous was created over 40 years ago? What are the differences in stadium design now?
Well, you know, stadium design has evolved quite a bit over the past four decades. But fundamentally, it's remained the same in many, many key ways. It's about bringing people together and, you know, coming together for shared, powerful experiences will always be central, I think, to the design of these types of places. But as you mentioned, you know, a lot of innovation has taken place, whether it's ballparks or arenas or stadiums. Certainly, you know, transformational shifts in the industry has really driven a lot of this change. And recently with the Sphere in Las Vegas, I think that was a quantum leap forward in a lot of ways for the concert going experience. But fundamentally, it's about people and what do people want. And ultimately, when you're talking about concerts, new ways for artists to bring their artistry and their incredible show productions to the world in new and dynamic ways. And so as we think about architecture and we think about the physical places that bring people together, we're always pushing the boundaries in terms of where we're going to go next.
How hard is it to design a venue that it makes a good experience for a sporting event and a good experience for a concert? Can every venue be both?
I'm not sure every venue is both, but I do think that you know, there's a lot of consideration that goes into you know, major projects like this to ensure that you have really great entertainment across the board without compromise, and so depending on what the venue is, you know, and certainly large scale venues, you know, where you can host an NFL game. You're talking about bringing, you know, 70, 75,000 people, you know, for an NFL event. But then also, you know, making sure that you have the infrastructure and the design considerations in place where you can have Taylor Swift or Beyonce. And you know, when you're looking at those types of large scale venues, there's so many factors that have to go into play in terms of a lot of the things that certainly, you know, fans experience in terms of, you know, parking and great concourse experiences and places for brand activation moments and hospitality experiences and certainly the in-seat experience itself, great sight lines. All those things are really critical. But equally important are the things that a fan wouldn't ever typically see in terms of what's in the back of house, then artist dressing rooms, and how do crews load in and load out, you know, all of the equipment and in the show production components. They all have to work together in concert. And so it truly is a pretty complex solution and problem we're trying to solve for, but they all have to work together. And so, you know, ultimately what we try to do is to ensure that across the wide spectrum of entertainment, that will be programmed in these buildings, that we create an environment without compromise.
Now, some of these venues, like I mentioned earlier, Tanglewood, Red Rocks, and now the Sphere, people just want to see them. So now the venue has become an attraction where if you happen to be on vacation in the area, it doesn't matter who's performing. You're going to just go because you want to see the venue. Have you found that venues are becoming a draw for cities?
Venues absolutely are a draw, and you just mentioned some of the most some of the best examples. You know, Red Rocks is legendary, of course. You know, right on the Front Range of the Rockies, and is such an amazing place, right? To watch a show. The Sphere in Las Vegas has become, you know, really iconic in its own way. In the way that it's constantly evolving from a media perspective, but, you know, at an emotional resonance, you know, standpoint, you know, when people are inside of that auditorium, you know, they're seeing a show and they're seeing an artist, they're experiencing an artist in a way that they never have many times in their entire life. And the way that the spectacle, you know, comes to life, and the way that the music is intertwined with incredible visuals, it really is quite an emotional, spiritual experience in a lot of ways. And so the venue does play an important role, right? It's not the only part of a concert or show experience, but the right type of venue is really an incredible, you know, part of the overall, you know, concert going opportunity. you know, the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville is very similar, right? It's almost like a pilgrimage that many fans will take just to be able to see a show in a special place. And so in those ways, the venue itself does play a pretty important role.
When building a new venue or doing a major renovation, who has the final say in the design? Is it the city? Is it a sports team owner? Is it Live Nation? Does everyone play a role in what it looks like?
There are many stakeholders, right, in these processes, especially when you're talking about a billion-dollar investment. It really depends on who's, you know, financing a project and bringing the capital to the project. Sometimes it's completely privately financed. Oftentimes there is a city or municipality that's part. We certainly work with great operators across the board. We have, as you mentioned, Live Nation, oftentimes will have a voice. So you're serving a lot of interests, really important interests from a stakeholder group standpoint. It's oftentimes not one person. It's many people. And so in that regard, arriving at the right design solution is ultimately serving the needs of many folks.
Now, in more recent years, cities and sports teams owners are thinking about multi-use venues. So everything that's being built new, especially, is a multi-use venue. But I have to think when they built Ohio Stadium here in Columbus 100 years ago, they probably were not planning for Buckeye Country Superfest, right? So how do old stadiums like that, 100-year-old Ohio Stadium, how can they be redesigned, especially sound-wise, for a concert? Or does that not matter? Do people just want to be there?
You know, in an open-air setting, and especially in a great, like, iconic venue, what you have at Ohio State, what you really need, right, is ultimately, when you're hosting a concert, you have to have the area, you know, that you can allocate for a large scale, stage production. There's a lot of new innovative ways in which, sound is dispersed in a venue like that. We have, large speaker clusters, what they call repeater towers that are set up, right? Large places where the stage itself can be erected and have, multimedia displays and things of that nature. The venue itself, needs to be able to support the same demands as they would, football game day, in many respects. And you have power requirements and you have all sorts of infrastructure requirements and things of that nature. But most venues in a large scale capacity can be able to host the demands of today's, concerts. We worked on a very similar project in many respects in College Station with Texas A&M, and at that time was the largest renovation projects in college history, where they expanded their capacity to over 100,000 fans. Mm-hmm. And you have a very similar situation in Columbus with Ohio State in that stadium. But really, the demands can be met, across the board, and typically in most of these venues. And certainly when artists are wanting to play to a large, stadium capacity of, 75, 85, 90,000 fans, most of the time those needs can be met.
Can you fix anything? Can you make it work with the right amount of speakers?
You can do a lot there's a lot of science, right? And there's a lot, that goes into the acoustics in terms of the right acoustical design. And so these large scale, productions, there's quite a bit, right, that goes into the show package, right? That's part of, part of the mobile show that's going from city to city. But, look at Lady Gaga. She just played a show in Rio de Janeiro for 2.5 million people. In terms of, having the right, type of show production, the right speaker arrays, it's pretty sophisticated. And there's a lot of, science that goes into making sure that you can deliver that type of audio experience for that massive amount of people. But, from an engineering perspective and the types of things that go into the production itself, you can solve for most demands.
Well, and in the age of social media, you hear about it when things go wrong. There were complaints at some venues that people could not hear Taylor Swift over the crowd noise of everyone singing. Mm-hmm. And then there's also other complaints at some Beyonce concerts that giant speakers are blocking their view. So how do you please everyone?
You know, I'm not sure that you can please everyone. I think that you do the best job that you can do, knowing that these show productions are, you know, they're temporary, right? You're going into, you know, each venue is going to have its own architectural, you know, demands, right? Each site is going to be, you know, uniquely different. Dallas Cowboys Stadium, you know, is going to be different than SoFi, is going to be different than MetLife, right? Each has its own, you know, architectural, you know, infrastructure, right, that you're working from. I think that, you know, ultimately, when you're going to a large scale stadium show where you have, you know, 70,000, you know, fans, part of this is being there. You know, part of this it's a pilgrimage in many respects. It's a cultural moment. You want to be part of something, and you know, you want to scream in unison, right? Mm-hmm. You want to sing the songs together, and I think that that's a really important part of this. You know, if you want like a really fine grained audio, you know, acoustical experience, you might choose to go to a show that's in a you know, it's in an auditorium or something that's smaller scale where it's just a finely tuned, you know, acoustical experience. And while I think that you still are getting something really, really, you know, high level and wonderful in a stadium show, it's about being together and kind of having that shared spiritual energy that you are part of something and part of something exciting when you're there with that many people. And so, you know, yes, I think there's always going to be, you know, times where you might have people that, you know, could complain because, you know, maybe a sight line could be obstructed, or I might not have heard something, you know, quite as clearly because it's in an open air setting and you're in the, you know, nosebleeds of an upper deck. Oftentimes that's overcome with this incredible opportunity to be together, something that's mass scale, and to be able to say that I was there for that moment.
Our guest has been Brian McGrackian, Senior Principal and Co-Director of Populous, a live venue design firm in Kansas City. Brian, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Amy.
And thank you for joining us. This has been All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.